Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Year in Review, as today we talk about the most recent relevant data sets in breast cancer. We have a great faculty today, Dr. Joyce O'Shaughnessy from the Baylor University Medical Center in Dallas, Texas, and Professor Peter Schmidt from the Barts Hospital in London, United Kingdom. As always, if you have any questions or cases you'd like to run by our faculty, just type them into the chat room. We'll bring up as many of these as we have time. As always, we put a little one-minute quiz in the beginning and in the end of the webinar here today. If you could take that, you'll get a lot more out of the meeting today, and we'll learn a little bit about you. If you're into audio programs, we know a lot of people end up listening to our webinars. Check out our Oncology Today podcast series, including a recent program with Dr. Modi talking about HER2-low breast cancer. This is really our first webinar of 2023. In the next month or so, we'll be doing a bunch of these year-in-review programs. Actually, tomorrow we'll be doing one on chronic lymphocytic leukemia with another great faculty. Next week, we'll be doing a program on multiple myeloma. We did a big seminar at ASH on myeloma as well. And then next week on Wednesday, we'll be doing a year-in-review program on targeted therapy of non-small cell. Hard to get through all that in 1 hour nowadays. So much to talk about. But then we're going to be heading out to the GI Symposium in San Francisco that we go to every year. And we're doing 3 symposium there, but all these will be broadcast live online. So first, we have a great faculty for a program on colorectal cancer. The next night, the 19th, on gastroesophageal cancer. And then on Friday, hepatobiliary cancer. So much going on in HCC and biliary tract cancer for that matter. But today we're here to talk about breast cancer. And of course, we can't talk about all that in 1 hour, but we tried to pick out some of the highlights. Basically, what we do in this series is I meet with the faculty individually and I record kind of a comprehensive presentation and discussion going through a lot of papers. I've already done that with both of our faculty now in the last couple of weeks. Those are posted in the chat room, and also we'll be sending this out as an email along with the version of this meeting tonight. And ideally, best way to get the most out of this program is watch the 2 presentations, then watch or listen to what we're going to do here today. So we're going to focus. We pulled out some of the slides that the faculty presented, some of the more interesting, controversial papers, of course, a lot from San Antonio. But also, I just want to kind of get warmed up with a paper we didn't even ask you to cover, but I got so many people asking me about it, I decided, let me bring this up. It's very practical and such an important issue, which is the issue of pregnancy in patients who are on adjuvant endocrine therapy. This is presented by Dr. Ann Partridge from Dana-Farber. Of course, she's had an international leadership role in premenopausal patients. Joyce, basically, it was a one-arm, study to follow these patients prospectively. They stopped their endocrine therapy between 18 and 30 months in an attempt to get pregnant. Most of the patients actually got pregnant, more than 70%, within the 2-year period that they were allowed to be off therapy. And the long-term follow-up data, you can see the type of hormonal therapy that was given. And so far, everything looks great. I think their conclusion about the need to incorporate patient-centered reproductive health care and the management of younger women with breast cancer is a real message. I'm curious, Joyce, what you thought about the presentation, and I'm curious how you approach this issue. How long are you comfortable keeping a woman off endocrine therapy? How do you factor in risk of recurrence?
Yeah, this was a terrifically important trial, long-awaited international registry trial. And the patients were mainly stage 1 and 2, very few stage 3, HR positive, HER2 negative patients. And they had been on at least 18 to 30 months. As you said, Neil, other endocrine therapy, super important. I've been comfortable historically with 2 to 3 years. I don't like to interrupt endocrine therapy, of course, but of course we have to. Patients really have to complete their families. And so 2 years were allowed. If patients hadn't conceived within a year, it was recommended they go ahead and do fertility treatment. So that was also allowed. We don't have a subset analysis in those patients yet. Not everybody had gotten back on therapy. That's really important. That's a challenge sometimes, getting gals to get back on their endocrine therapy, although the vast majority did. So there were recurrences. This is a short follow-up, first of all. It's only 41 months, I think it is, median follow-up. So short follow-up, there are recurrences. And they looked at it They did a kind of a case control analysis using the soft and text data, age matched, stage matched, treatment matched. And it looked a little better. It looked like the gals were doing a little better than the soft and text in terms of recurrences. And what very interesting, provocative graph they showed is that the women who got pregnant, the 70%+ who got pregnant versus those who didn't, it looked like those who got pregnant were doing a little better, like 2.5% recurrence versus about 5% recurrence. So small, tiny numbers. But so basically, it was reassuring. I personally started to get really nervous at about a year, year and a half. They let the gals go 2 years. So short follow-up, lower stage disease, lower risk patients, relatively smaller numbers, but still reassuring. But I still, of course, want to get the gals back on endocrine therapy as soon as possible.
So Peter, Ann made a really great comment as part of the presentation that the idea was not only to survive, but thrive, which I thought was really a great comment. I'm amazed they got 500 women in this study. What a fantastic effort. Any thoughts about it, Peter? One of the issues that was discussed was how long do you have to be off tamoxifen? I think the label says 8 months, but they did 3 months, I think, and Ann justified it based on the PK of tamoxifen. How do you approach it? Any thoughts about these data, Peter?
So I think the data are hugely important. I look at three aspects in there. The first aspect is sort of the chances of having a successful pregnancy. The second is if I may use the term, the risk for the unborn child. What is the malformation rate? And we got confirmation that that risk is very, very low. The first child is obviously, as you and Joyce mentioned, 74% of women managed to get pregnant. And the third factor we are looking at is the risk in terms of breast cancer recurrence. And it's a little bit short, the follow-up. It's relatively low-risk women, but it's hugely reassuring, hugely reassuring to see that there doesn't seem to be an excessively increased risk of recurrences at this point in time. In terms of washout, how do I approach it? I think 8 months is excessive. And in reality, it takes several weeks to months for the whole, what I would say, hormonal cycle to get back to normal once women can come off tamoxifen. So in reality, you're already through those 2 to 3 months by the time women consider getting pregnant. And in my clinical practice, that doesn't seem to be a challenging factor.
Okay, well, let's go through some of the papers that you all discuss in your presentations. We're going to start out with metastatic disease because, I don't know, from my global point of view, there is the story of the year in breast cancer. Antibody drug conjugates, TDXD, and HER2 low. Of course, a lot of other things happened that we're just going to briefly sort of glide through. But Peter, Joyce went through first DESTINY-03. I guess it was last year's ESMO. It seems like years ago. Was it last year? I can't believe it. DESTINY-03. It seems like so long ago. But anyhow, that trial blew everybody's mind, of course. And we saw follow-up now on the study, now with a survival benefit that was presented by Sarah Hurvitz at San Antonio. Pretty good hazard rate of 0.64. Not a huge surprise given the incredible impact. Just the whole idea that one antibody drug conjugate would be so much better than another, Peter, I think was one of the first messages that came through about antibody drug conjugates in general. This is another issue that Joyce talked about in her presentation. We'll get a little more into that as the issue of brain mets. And we saw this small study that took CETA study, only 15 people, yet they saw the majority of these people responded in the brain. Let's talk a little bit about brain mets first. So we also saw a follow-up from the HER-CLIMB study, particularly the effect on CNS. And Joyce talked about the HER2 guidelines that came out, Peter, and a couple of things that I thought was interesting. Again, this just came out in the JCO, because obviously now we have our HER-CLIMB with tucatinib, but also we're seeing, you know, benefit of TDXD in the brain. So I guess one question I wanted to ask you, Peter, is how do you approach second-line therapy in patients who have brain mets, particularly if they are untreated and asymptomatic? First of all, what kind of anti-HER strategy are you going to use? Are you going to go with tucatinib? What about if they have a lot of liver mets? Would you think about T-DXd? How do you think through second-line therapy, Peter, on people with brain mets?
A difficult question. I mean, we haven't got head-to-head comparison data between tucatinib and T-DXd, but if we allow cross-trial comparison, we see that T-DXd is, in general, substantially more effective than the tucatinib combination. If you look at just the PFS in a second, third-line setting with T-DXd, it's a completely different dimension compared to what we see with tucatinib. So I think we do have a more effective drug in terms of extracranial disease. And the question is, does it have the same activity for intracranial disease? The data we have seen from the small group of patients on the DESTINY-Breast03 trial, but also from the TUXEDO trial, suggest two things. The drug gets into the brain, but also it has high activity there. So for me, very clearly, the treatment of choice at the moment is to use T-DXd as early as possible. And I would say it is, for me personally, the more effective drug in this setting. We also tend to be quite proactive in terms of brain radiotherapy and increasingly using stereotactic radiotherapy methods rather than whole brain radiotherapy. And therefore, the issue of not having radiotherapy options for patients is sort of getting slightly lower because we don't always start with whole brain radiotherapy as we did 10, 15 years ago. And so we have relatively few patients with untreated brain metastasis where that seems to be the limiting problem.
So, Joyce, again, I'm kind of curious, we have a patient who has minimal systemic disease. Maybe they're progressing, but still not, you know, really life-threatening. They have a lot of brain mets. What are you going to do in terms of her therapy there, her climb, T-DXd? And how do you approach the issue of giving systemic therapy? And this kind of comes out of lung cancer to me, is where we start to see people using systemic therapy, holding off on radiation. How do you approach that decision, particularly if they have a little bit of symptoms?
I think these ASCO guideline points that you have up here, Neil, are worth reviewing, just so we know what the consensus opinion is from our experts. And basically, they are sticking with the idea that if the systemic disease is not progressive at the time of brain metastasis, to go ahead and treat the brain metastasis locally, continue their systemic therapy. And then if they are progressing both systemically as well as in the brain, they're basically saying, use your standard HER2-targeted treatment algorithms, okay, is what they're saying. But the third point, what they're saying is that with regard to active progressing untreated brain mets, they're giving permission for the tucatinib triplet and to holding off on cranial irradiation. And then the last bullet point says that for stable treated brain met patients, either T-DXd or the tucatinib triplet. So our guidelines are kind of giving a priority to the tucatinib triplet for active brain mets. And that's, of course, because of the HER2 climb survival data that we've seen, you know, in the active brain metastasis. We have relatively little data. As Peter pointed out, the TUXEDO trial is active brain mets. You showed those, that waterfall plot. It's very, very effective, but it's really just a small, of course, it led to Nature Medicine paper, but it's not, we don't have survival data specifically in that group. I actually think that, you know, either approach is fine. Neil, I tend to still probably use the tucatinib regimen in the second line setting for patients whose life limiting issue is brain metastasis. And then I would go on to T-DXd third line. I use T-DXd mostly second line, but for the patients where really the brain metastasis is what is going to be their life-limiting issue, I still mainly go with the HER2 climb data because of the survival data.
So let's talk a little bit about DESTINY-Breast04. I'm calling this the paper of the year in oncology, not just breast cancer. It's really has had such a huge impact on people in the field in and outside of breast cancer and really thinking about ADCs. And I really recommend you check out the section of Joyce's talk where she goes through this because there's a lot going on. We're going to show a little bit of that, but there's really a lot to see here. I think everybody's pretty quite familiar with the HER2 low data. But Peter, I wanted to ask you what your thoughts were, again, getting back to brain mets. There was a paper presented at San Antonio looking at HER2 low brain mets. And even though it's not a huge number of patients, it kind of looks like it works, like the TUXEDO study. What was your take, Peter? And any thoughts about that?
So for systemic therapy to have a benefit for patients with brain metastasis, we need two things. The drug needs to get into the brain. It's very simplistic, and it needs to induce an objective response. Now, we know that these antibody drug conjugates can pass blood-brain barrier, which often is also not intact when patients actually have developed brain metastasis. And secondly, we have seen in DESTINY-Breast04, but also in all ADC studies, that the objective response rates are really high outside the brain. And we would expect the same to happen in the brain if the drug gets there. So for me, this is just confirmation that these drugs can penetrate the blood-brain barrier and therefore be effective against brain metastases.
So, Joyce, a couple of practical issues. Again, so many questions come up about T-DXd nowadays, and of course, the ILD is a big issue. It seems like as we go earlier, we're seeing less ILD. But one of the issues is what happens if you do develop ILD? And I guess the algorithm that we have, the plan that we have, is if they have symptoms, they're going to have the T-DXd stopped. So the idea is pick it up before they have symptoms, maybe dose reduce, and see if you can get them back on that. How do you go about screening for that, Joyce? I'm keep hoping there's going to be more direction on that. When I ask investigators, they say, well, just try to get scans as much as you can. But like you keep doing this at a year, at 2 years, it's if you're fortunate enough to have a long response. Any thoughts in general about how you approach screening for ILD? And do you ask your patients, you have your nurses ask them for symptoms proactively?
Yeah, this is an evolving area and one that I think I'm altering my practice pattern. Neil, it's a point worth pointing out in the DESTINY-Breast03, the median PFS was 28.8 months. Think about that, 28.8 months median PFS. That's unbelievable. Remember first-line Cleopatra, 18 months, okay? And then if you got a response, which was 80-plus percent of patients, median duration of response, 3 years. Unbelievable. And when they gave the updated data, the ILD rate went from 10% on their original presentation to 15%. So with longer exposure, you get more ILD. Mostly in the first year, but unfortunately it can happen even up to 2 years. So the only way we can keep the drug going with ILD is to catch it asymptomatic, treat with steroids, reduce the dose, and resume. If they get symptoms, we got to stop permanently. So we always ask about symptoms. But Neil, what I'm hearing from all of my friends, I'm asking everybody, are you guys doing scans every 9 to 12 weeks? And the answer is yes. In people who don't need the scans for their cancer. In fact, I was just talking to one of the breast cancer experts in our country about an hour ago, and I asked her. She's doing it every 6 to 9 weeks. Wow. Neil, I haven't been doing that, but I get it. I get it, and I'm gonna start doing it. Because the only way you can keep the patients on this drug is to catch it asymptomatic, treat, reduce the dose, resume. But once they have symptoms, you're done.
Any thoughts, Peter? Again, I do things like Joyce when I don't see it in the literature. I just start asking people and see whether or not they all start saying the same thing. And I've been hearing more and more people say what Joyce just said. What are your thoughts, Peter?
I mean, I think we will learn a lot about how we manage ILD in clinical practice. The trials were very clear. If you have grade 2 or higher, which means symptomatic pneumonitis, you have to come off treatment. But we all know in reality this is slightly gray. A lot of patients with metastatic breast cancer are slightly short of breath because of fatigue, because of anemia. And so if you ask very carefully, which of those patients are really, truly, completely asymptomatic? So the key question for us will be to see which of those symptoms can be assigned to the ground glass changes we see on the scan, and which of the patients in the future who may be mildly symptomatic can carry on with the treatment or not. And I think there will be in the future probably a group of patients we could classify as grade 2, but with very mild symptoms that may be able to carry on. And if you have clearly ILD-associated symptoms, then of course you need to stop. So it's early detection, but also assigning what is actually treatment-associated symptom in contrast to, for example, cancer-associated symptoms.
So it's always difficult to pull myself away from T-DXd. So I'll just do one more question. I actually came in the chat room, Joyce, from Jaya. Wants to know, in terms of, you know, sort of labeling a patient as, quote, HER2 low, the understanding that this person has is that if you see it, even if you see HER2 zero later, if you ever see a 1+ or 2+, it's there. You can call them HER2-low and use T-DXd. And Joyce, I mean, do you have people like who run out of options that are, you know, HER2-0 that you don't use it in, or do you find it?
I try to find it, Neil, but yeah, Ajaya's question, if your primary breast cancer was 2+ 10 years ago, and every single one you've had since that time in the metastatic setting is being read historically as 0, knowing that the pathologist didn't really look for the 1+, there wasn't any clinical reason to look for 1+ versus 0. The clinical trial, the DB04, they were eligible based on HER2-low centrally confirmed at any time on any of the tissue. So even just finding it once is enough. So that's what I hear everybody doing, and that's what I'm doing as well. And, you know, Neil, I just find it. I just find it. If somebody has no other options, I go back through every one and I'll re-biopsy. But also there's you can do reverse phase protein array of called the Therolink study and a Therolink assay. And they'll, it's highly, highly sensitive. They'll find some HER2 protein or phosphoprotein expression, even if you don't find it by IHC. So I can usually find it.
So as always, the chat room's blowing up with questions about T-DXd, but I'm going to pull ourselves away from it because there are a lot of other great things that are happening. And one thing is really interesting, again, Joyce went through, is really new developments in endocrine treatment of breast cancer. We really, this is the first time in a long time we're seeing some really new developments that look like they're going to have an impact on practice. And Peter, Joyce went through the issue of this, well, starting out with this study, the PETA-1 study, looking for ESR1 mutations in liquid biopsies as a means to determine whether or not to continue palbociclib. And you can see that if they switched early, you know, maybe even patients who are clinically stable are going to get switched once they developed ESR1 mutations. This is a sort of an initial look at that. But also, Joyce, you talked about this new agent, capivasertib. This is an AKT inhibitor. Can you talk a little bit about how it works, Joyce? This is a phase 3 study just presented a few weeks ago in San Antonio, a positive study. Looks like it's, you know, works, it's tolerable. Seems very likely it's going to get approved. Joyce, can you kind of capsulize what we know about this agent and where you see it fitting into practice?
This is one of the presentations I was most happy about at San Antonio, and I really cannot wait to have this agent in practice. It's called CAPI for short, capivasertib. It's an oral AKT-1-2-3 inhibitor. So it does inhibit wild-type AKT, but it inhibits mutant AKT. We see a lot of AKT-1 mutations that are acquired in breast cancer, or it inhibits P10 loss. We don't have anything for AKT mutations right now or for P10 loss patients. So these patients had already progressed through an AI. 70% of them had already had a CDK4/6 inhibitor, and they were randomized to fulvestrant plus minus capivasertib. And it was an intent to treat population, and about 40% of the patients had a known genomic alteration of either AKT mutation activating, PIK3CA mutation, which was most of the patients, or a P10 genomic loss. About 40%. And in this slide, you can see in the top, the PFS was positive in the intent to treat population, about a doubling of PFS. And also down the bottom, even a little better, a hazard of 0.5 in the AKT altered population. But even in the patients that had AKT pathway wild type, we know you can get pathway activation by other ways than just these mutations. And the hazard was 0.7. And the composite intervals did not cross 1. So it was active, not as active as this, but still good in the patients with, there it is there, in the patients who had AKT wild type. And you can see in the top right, in the liver mets, and also in patients who had a CDK4/6 inhibitor, the hazards are 0.6. That's really, really important. We need benefit for liver metastasis. And you can see the response rates, like bottom, bottom right, about a tripling of the response rate from 10% to almost 30% in the AKT pathway altered. This drug is taken 4 days, you take it, and 3 days you're off per week. And that's because of diarrhea. To get patients to stop the diarrhea, during the 3 days off. So it's manageable. There's some rash. They were allowed with a hemoglobin A1C up to 8%. And so that's a very, not that much hyperglycemia. So you're not going to get the hyperglycemia that we see with alpelisib. So I'm super excited because I'm hope this is going to give us more options for patients with PIK3CA mutations. We need more options. I like alpelisib. I use it. But this is another option for the patients. I don't have anything for AKT, nothing for P10. These liver mets, they're all about the PI3 kinase pathway. So we really need this agent. And this is a great, I was really happy with this trial.
So Peter, any thoughts about this? You know, this idea of using, 4 days on, 3 days. I wonder if you did that with alpelisib, how that would go. Because of course we hear a lot about toxicity with alpelisib. Any experience with this agent, Peter? And what are your thoughts if it does become available, sort of where it's going to fit in? Is it going to come before or instead of alpelisib, for example? What about everolimus? You know, what about, you know, and HER2-low TDXD?
So I think we can hit this pathway three levels at the moment. We can go in on the PR3K level, we can go sort of intermediate level AKT, and we can go on the lower level and mTOR. The pathways obviously are complex, and there are differences in activity in the biology depending on which level you go in. But we see similar activity between mTOR inhibitors if you look at the old everolimus data, if you look at the alpelisib data, and if you now look at the capivasertib data, AKT. So it's hugely reassuring to see that these drugs work on different levels. But what Choi's already mentioned is the tolerability is a key factor here. And we struggle with alpelisib in the clinic. It's a drug that is effective, but it's not very well tolerated by patients. Now, capivasertib has a much shorter half-life, and therefore some of the toxicities we see, for example, hyperglycemia, is much less an issue with capivasertib compared to alpelisib. So I think it is first of all hugely encouraging to see this substantial benefit, not just in terms of PFS but also in terms of OS, but secondly to see that the drug actually has a really relatively favorable toxicity profile, and I think it will play a role in clinic going forward, and possibly push alpelisib a little bit further back.
So, Joyce, you also talked about oral SERDs. I always thought fulvestrant was one of the coolest drugs in oncology. When I first heard about oral SERDs, I was like, that's great. You can give them more of it, no injections. And yet it kind of seems like it's a little bit, let's say, a winding course getting here. We saw some negative trials, but now it looks like we're starting to see positive study. You talked about the drug elacestrant, which seems to have activity. It's compared to a fulvestrant. Particularly, it seems like patients with these ESR1 mutations, and I'm wondering, you know, how ESR1 assays or liquid biopsies are going to fit into clinical practice. So, you know, we have this agent that looks promising, perhaps is going to be approved in the near future. We also have another SERD. We saw more data at San Antonio on camizestrant in this study, SERENA-2 trial, comparing it to fulvestrant and two different doses, and looks like better than fulvestrant, particularly in the patients who have ESR1 mutations. So, Joyce, what about the oral SERDs? What about combining the oral SERDs with a drug like cami? Where do you see this heading?
I think the oral SERDs are a really good step forward, and I really, really hope we see availability of elacestrant, you know, in the near future with the FDA. What's clear is that these agents are really something that are going to be effective for patients whose breast cancers have developed an ESR1 mutation. They're not going to help every patient, but those that have some biologic and clinical characteristics suggesting that they still could really have ER-driven disease. Fulvestrant, we're learning the median PFS is right around 2 months with ESR1 mutations in countless trials now. And now we're up to, you know, 5, 6, 8 months of median PFS with camizestrant and with elacestrant in ESR1 mutant. And what I've learned is that ESR1 mutation means in most patients, the cancer is still ER dependent, but our current therapies don't work. So we got to have some agents that get these mutations, and elacestrant and camizestrant and imlunestrant and giredestrant, they all get it. We've seen this now in the data. So anyway, it's very encouraging, but it is going to be for ER driven breast cancer. Somebody's blowing through in the liver, it's not going to work for them. They blow through the CDK4/6 inhibitor, it's not going to work for them. But if they have a history of long PFS on CDK4/6, we saw data from the Emerald trial that those are the patients that get 8.5 months median PFS if they got an ESR1 mutation. One point I'll make too, Neil, though, and Virginia Caclamani said this at San Antonio from the podium, and I really totally agree with her. ESR1 wild type, there's a proportion of those patients that have ER-dependent breast cancer. We know them. They got bone-only disease. They got the long natural history. The breast cancer is still ER positive. These patients also benefit from elacestrant. So I'd really like to see availability for both the mutant and the intent-to-treat population.
So, Peter, any thoughts about oral SERDs? It's being looked at in the adjuvant setting. I know there's one study looking at it in people who aren't tolerating conventional hormonal therapy. Any thoughts about where oral SERDs are heading, Peter?
So at the moment, these drugs are clearly likely to be the most effective single-agent endocrine treatment. I think we see, as Joyce pointed out, we see that most of the benefit is clearly ER-driven disease, but also what we call ligand-independent estrogen receptor activation. That's usually driven by estrogen receptor mutation or ESR1 mutations. It's actually interesting if you look at that subgroup of patients, the data between the different oral SERDs are remarkably consistent. The hazard ratio is around 0.6 in all the different programs. And if one of the studies isn't positive, then it's probably about the percentage of patients who had ESR1 mutations, which varies between the different trials. So it's a very encouraging signal. And I think we will also see that those drugs will move forward into the adjuvant setting. It'll be interesting to see what benefit we will see there in terms of emerging resistance and how we can overcome that.
So let's talk a little bit about antibody drug conjugates. As I was mentioning, moving out of HER2. Now, Joyce, you won't believe how dense I am. Just right now, looking at this slide, is the first time I realized why they call it the TROPIC study, TROP2. Sorry, I'm very, very dense. But anyhow, just pick that up. Anyhow, we've been using sacituzumab in triple negative disease, Joyce, and then we started to see data coming along in hormone receptor positive disease, and we saw more data from that Hope presented at San Antonio. Now you see a survival benefit. Any comments on sacituzumab in general, Joyce, in terms of where you're sequencing it? And particularly where, again, the ER-positive space, so many things coming into that. Sacituzumab has been there, but I think now with the survival data going to be even more prominent. Any thoughts about sacituzumab? And also, you talked about a drug we've been talking about a lot in our lung cancer series, datodiroxican, sort of same last name of TDXD, but now again, the TROP2 targeting. Any thoughts about where these two agents, both of them seem to have significant activity, how that's going to fit in an ER-positive disease, and for that matter, triple-negative disease, Joyce?
Yeah, sacituzumab, of course, we've been using it a lot in the triple-negative patients and in our patients who become resistant to KEYNOTE-522 data and recur early. It's really the only agent I find that really is highly non-cross resistant with the chemo we use in the curative setting. So it's very active as well in ER positive breast cancer. It's just very non-cross resistant. And the TROPiCS-02, those patients were very, very heavily pretreated, but you still see a survival advantage. You know, the issue now is with TDXD in the HER2 low population. Most of us are going to go with the TDXD in HER2 low and use the sacituzumab in HER2 zero. If I use TDXD and then have some intervening therapy, I will use sacituzumab later line because there wasn't there was a very heavily pretreated group in TROPiCS-02. So I think you can do a ADC with a topo one payload after same. You know, you can use different, you can use TDXD and use SASI later. With regard to triple negative disease, because of the ASCENT data, a prospective phase 3 with a survival advantage, even in HER2 low triple negative, I've been prioritizing sacituzumab over T-DXd because we still have limited data, just about 60 patients from DB04 that were triple negative HER2 low. So I still use sacituzumab as my go-to topo 1 ADC. But so sacituzumab now is in the adjuvant setting for our patients who, after our typical KEYNOTE-522 regimen preoperatively, still have residual disease. So it's in trials now, looking at that as a way to salvage patients and increase the cure rate. So I just think that these are going to move up into the curative setting. The Dato-DXd looks really equally excellent to sacituzumab. It's a small phase 2 experience so far, but both in triple negative and in HR positive breast cancer, it's highly active because it's the same target. It's TROP2 and it's a different TROPO1 payload, but very, very effective as well. They both have bystander effect, et cetera. So both of these are great agents, and it'll be nice to have Dato-DXd as well in practice. We don't yet.
So, Peter, any thoughts about this? One of the things for us trying to figure out is in differential toxicity. You know, we've heard about the stomatitis with the Dato-DXd from the lung cancer people. And, of course, we know the profile for sacituzumab in terms of cytopenias and diarrhea. Any thoughts, again, about how these agents might fit into practice maybe over the next year or two, I would think?
So really important questions. Now, one of the things we're learning is that every ADC has its unique toxicity profile. And that's neither just down to the target nor to the payload. Because, for example, if you compare Dato-DXd and T-DXd, we don't see the same amount of ILD despite the same platform. So it's a mix of target and payload we are seeing. We just have to get used to how we deal with those different side effects, and we're already developing strategies, for example, mucositis management, but also for some of the other ADCs, keratitis management or ILD management, as we discussed earlier. I think for the future will be important to develop rational sequential strategies. So if you start with ADC 1, what is the second ADC you're using? And again, in a very simplistic way, resistance to ADC is either driven by resistance to the target or by resistance to the payload. So it will be possible in some patients to give a second TROP2 target ADC. In other patients, we have to switch the platform. It will also be possible in some patients to give Dato-DXd first and T-DXd second, as a second drug. But in other patients, we have to switch to a different payload. And I think that will be our challenge in the next few years. In addition, we are trying to bring in, especially in triple negative breast cancer, the combination with immune therapy. And we saw interesting data again from the Begonia trial. In my opinion, really fantastic early activity. If you look at Dato-DXd and durvalumab in a first line setting in triple negative breast cancer, response rate of 74%. That's something we hadn't seen before. Now, if you look at the small print of that study, the majority of these patients were PD-L1 negative. And if you look at the response rate in KEYNOTE-355 or in PASSION-130, the registrational studies for the checkpoint inhibitors, in the PD-L1 negative population, response rates are around 45%. So in a completely different dimension in terms of activity. And my speculation would be that the ADCs will move into a first-line setting in triple-negative breast cancer alone and with immune checkpoint inhibitors.
So our GU colleagues are all excited about another ADC and enfortumab plus IO, pembrolizumab. They think that's going to be first-line therapy of metastatic urothelial bladder cancer. In this study you just talked about, same strategy, antibody-drug conjugate plus an IO durvalumab. Joyce, we could spend a lot of time talking about ADCs, but what about this one? We did a program with Dr. Passiani from MD, from Dana-Farber lung cancer doc, who really talked a lot about this agent, patritumab deruxtecan, again, same payload, but now targeting HER3. And Joyce, he mentioned that the other place you see activity is breast cancer, and we saw at ASCO data looking at that. Any thoughts about this agent, Joyce, and where you see it heading?
It's definitely active. You know, it is, I participated in a trial with this, the patritumab, and it's a little bit more toxic GI-wise, although T-DXd can be the same, but olanzapine at bedtime, 2.5 milligrams, just takes care of that beautifully. My question on this is really, where is this going to fit in? Because most of the HER3 positive breast cancers are also HER2 positive or HER2 low. And so we have such robust phase 3 data now with T-DXd. This possibly could be another ADC for down the road. Because it's got deruxtecan, we won't be using it immediately after T-DXd, but perhaps there will be a role for it. But I'm not sure, Neil, that we're going to see a big development for this agent, given how good targeting HER2 overexpression and HER2 low is with deruxtecan payload.
So to be continued, we'll see where things head. Peter, any comments on, we saw more data in the metastatic setting, IO, looking at pembrolizumab now with a survival benefit in patients with CPS over 10. Any thoughts, Peter, about the use of IO in metastatic triple-negative breast cancer and the role of PD-1 assay?
It's clearly a standard of care for patients with PD-1 positive disease. Now, that's defined at the moment with one of two assays. If you use the SP1 for 2 assay, it's a 1% cutoff. If you use the CPS assay, that's a cutoff of 10. And interesting, that sounds very different, but actually, both assays with the respective cutoffs define a population of around 40% of breast cancer patients. Those two assays overlap by 75%. So in other words, if you are PD-L1 negative, for example, with the ST1 for 2 assay, you still have a 10% chance of being PD-L1 positive with the 2-to-C3 or CPS assay. And so in clinical practice, I think it is at the moment helpful to use both assays in patients, because we want to maximize the chances that we find a patient with PD-L1 positive disease where we can then offer one of the immune checkpoint inhibitors.
So I'm going to flip over to Peter's talk on localized disease, and we'll talk about some of the papers that he covered in his talk. Here are some of the papers on ER positive disease. We're just going to talk about a couple of them. But I want to start out with this graphic that you showed, Peter, about what your approach was to the use of at least Oncotype in trying to decide about chemo or not. And then we'll talk about some data that was presented that really offers another very interesting approach to this, utilizing neoadjuvant endocrine therapy. So, Peter, can you kind of talk about this graphic to begin with?
Yeah, so if you look at the data we have from randomized trials, there was only one group left where it was slightly controversial whether we use chemotherapy and endocrine therapy or endocrine therapy alone. In patients with a low recurrence score, they always benefit most from endocrine therapy. In patients with high clinical risk, more than 4 lymph nodes, again, we would always give chemotherapy and endocrine therapy. In patients with 1 to 3 lymph nodes, again, the R-Exponder trial has shown very clearly in postmenopausal women, there's no benefit unless in the high recurrence score group. But in the immediate risk group, there is a benefit of chemotherapy if women are under the age of 50. But the interesting group is the N0 group, patients with an intermediate risk score, 11 to 25, where we see in the premenopausal women possibly a benefit from combination with chemotherapy. And again, we saw the updated data from Taylor X that support that and show that the higher the clinical risk is in that intermediate risk group, the more benefit we see. But we also saw elegant data from the WSG group that incorporated what we call a functional assay, giving women endocrine therapy for 3 weeks prior to surgery, and then define whether patients responded. The response is defined as a downregulation of Ki-67 of proliferation. And as you can see on the slide, 2/3 of patients respond with a downregulation of Ki-67. And those patients have clearly no benefit from chemotherapy, even if they're premenopausal in the intermediate risk group. Whereas patients who don't respond to the endocrine therapy do have a benefit. And so I think that's really an interesting addition. It's a very simple test for us to do. It's something we don't use often enough clinically, because most women in most countries wait at least 2 or 3 weeks between the diagnostic biopsy and the surgical date. It would be very easy for us to offer patients endocrine therapy. There was an interesting presentation, again, from the WSG group at ESMO that also looked at the Ki-67 downregulation dependent on age and menopausal status. And we always had felt that women, premenopausal women, may not benefit as much from endocrine therapy. But what was very clear here, if these women have optimal endocrine therapy, which means ovarian suppression plus then an AI or tamoxifen, their downregulation of Ki-67 is very much comparable to what we see in postmenopausal women. So for me, that answers an important question. It's not the biology that's different in premenopausal women. It's actually the treatment that's often ineffective we use if we don't add in ovarian suppression. And so the picture becomes a little bit clearer. And what I try to show in this slide is in women, so this N0 premenopausal group, if you now have clinical high risk, then these women would get chemotherapy and endocrine therapy. If you're clinically low risk, patients would get endocrine therapy alone. Or if there are endocrine responders based on the functional test, they would get endocrine therapy alone. And if they don't respond, they benefit from chemotherapy and endocrine therapy.
So Joyce, second opinion. One thing, I think Peter brought out the fact that a lot of, I thought, neoadjuvant endocrine therapy of premenopausal women, quote, didn't work. And yet, as he was saying, if you use ovarian suppression ablation with something else, usually AI, whatever, it does work. What do you think about his thoughts about using a functional assay to sort of add on to the Oncotype result and trying out hormonal therapy for 3 weeks and see what happens to the Ki-67?
I think it's very important, Neil. And this is a lovely slide here Peter put together. And the N0 patients, 16 to 20, and also the premenopausals, 11 to 25, these patients are going to be randomized in the NRG trial 09 to optimal endocrine therapy with an LHRH agonist plus an aromatase inhibitor. They may allow tamoxifen as well, with or without chemotherapy, because unfortunately, we think that a lot of the chemotherapy benefit we're seeing in premenopausal patients is due to ovarian ablation from the chemotherapy, because a very small minority of patients in Taylor X and R-Xponder got an LHRH agonist. So when I have a patient whose biology appears to be one that's really ER-driven, ER-PR strongly positive, grade 1 or 2, HER2 negative, of course, Ki-67, not very high, less than 20%. I'll send a 21 gene recurrence score. If they're node negative, node positive, I tend to treat them with chemotherapy. But if they have only one positive node and it's small and everything else looks very, very favorable, I think if I can give them preoperative 3 weeks of preoperative endocrine therapy in the ADAPT trial, they were giving tamoxifen. They didn't give those patients preoperative LHRH agonist plus AI. They gave them tamoxifen. But if they got that down regulation, they showed they didn't benefit at all from chemotherapy. They had to get the Ki-67 less than 10%. So there are some patients I do not give every single node negative or one positive node patient who's premenopausal chemotherapy. If their biology is favorable and the recurrence score comes back at the lower end of the 11 to 25, and if I can give them preoperative tamoxifen for 3 weeks before surgery and they come back suppressed, I talked to them about the totality of the data and the fact that the 09 trial is going to go on and randomize these patients to chemotherapy. So I use that. I think it's an important thing we can use in both pre and postmenopausal women to get a feel, because we do know that down regulation for Ki-67 does really predict for patients doing well with endocrine therapy.
So these are some of the papers that Peter reviewed in terms of localized triple negative breast cancer. We saw, of course, the survival data from the Olympia study looking at olaparib, and that's beyond triple negative, of course, in terms of ER positive, HER2 negative. And we also saw data from his study looking at the 522 study looking at neoadjuvant chemo IO. But first, in terms of the Olympia data, I would just want to ask you, Peter, how do you approach the patient with triple negative disease, for example, who has a BRCA mutation, germline BRCA mutation, and how do you work in, or what do you deal with? How do you deal with the issue of pembrolizumab. We saw the survival data now with olaparib. The benefits of olaparib seem to be increasing with time, but also, you know, you reviewed the most recent data from your study looking at pembrolizumab, showing, you know, disease-free survival benefit. And then this fascinating data set presented at ASCO, looking at event-free survival based on residual disease. Can you talk a little bit about, let's just focus on triple negative to start with, Peter, yeah. Both in the BRCA wild type and BRCA mutant, how you approach it?
So if you focus on stage two and stage three disease, because that's where we have the data for PARP inhibitors, that's where we have data for immunotherapy, it is very clear my preference would be to give chemotherapy and immunotherapy in the neoadjuvant setting, and patients who have a PARP CR, whether they are BRCA mutant or wild type, have a fantastic outlook. If patients have residual disease, then I would consider them per treatment as per the Olympia study and give them a PARP inhibitor. The difficult question is, would we combine PARP inhibitor with pembrolizumab in that setting? And obviously, it's a data-free zone. I personally would consider that, knowing that I can combine a PARP inhibitor and an immune checkpoint inhibitor safely. But that is a question for future studies. What we tried to achieve with the ASCO presentation for KEYNOTE-522 was looking into, are we actually changing the biology by adding immune therapy, or do we just induce a shift in response to induce more responses and have a more an RCB shift? But what we could see is that patients in each RCB subgroup, so patients who have the equivalent response to treatment, whether it's with immune therapy or without immune therapy, have a better outlook if they received immune therapy. So that answers for me the question that immune therapy doesn't just work through a better response, but actually changes the biology of the disease, including the residual disease. It confirms what we showed right at the beginning with the EFS data. The patients who you would classify as non-responders to immune therapy, who have residual disease, still have a substantially better outlook if they received, and probably if they continue immune therapy.
So Peter Ibrahim in the chat room says, quote, I understand the 522 data now shows reduction in CNS recurrence. Is that true? I haven't heard that.
So we haven't presented the CNS data specifically. It's obviously an important area to look at. Where's the first site of disease recurrence? And we always know that the brain is a slight sanctuary in terms of what cancer cells get to. And neither chemotherapy, nor possibly immune therapy has the optimal effect. So we will show data there in the future about the first site of disease recurrence.
So, yeah, I don't know whether Ibrahim had a dream. Maybe he has a prescient dream about it that you will report that. Another question from the chat room, Joyce, going back to Oncotype. Daniel wants to know, what about just using ovarian suppression or ablation in intermediate premenopausal patients, you know, offering that as an option? So I guess I'd ask you, in what situations would you do that rather than chemo, Joyce?
Yeah, and Peter's nice table showed that if it's clinical high risk, 16 and above, in Taylor X, they benefit from chemotherapy. And if it's clinical low risk, even 21 to 25, they benefit from the chemotherapy. So those are the data we have. And so it kind of pushes us to try to use chemotherapy. But that's exactly the question that we're all really struggling with is, does everybody need chemo, or can we give them an LHRH agonist plus AI? And that's exactly the question that the NRG09 trial is going to address. Everybody gets optimal endocrine therapy plus minus chemotherapy, where right now the premenopausals, right now we're obligated or feel obligated for the most part to give them chemotherapy. So there's not a right or wrong answer about how to parse that out. But what I do is, if all the biological characteristics looks favorable, if the patients come back in less than 21, so 20 or less, if the Ki-67, if I see a Ki-67 30% or higher, I'm very worried. It's a genomically unstable, aggressive breast cancer. I've got to give chemotherapy. But if it's a 20% or less Ki-67, the 21 gene recurrence score is low. If I can give them the preoperative endocrine therapy for 3 weeks and they suppress nicely to less than 10%, I feel even better. So yes, I don't give everybody chemotherapy. I do what you're suggesting, which is the LHRH agonist and AI in some patients, but it's still unclear, which is why we need the randomized trial.
So I've got a couple more papers that talk about and localized HER2-positive disease, one from the ESMO virtual plenary, more follow-up from the AFFINITY trial, adjuvant pertuzumab, and then neoadjuvant TDXD with or without anastrozole. But before we get into that, a couple more questions from the chat room. So Susan wants to know, Peter, how do you approach the patients who are HER2-low and hormone receptor negative, formerly, I don't know what you're going to call them, triple-negative, HER2-low, or what we call them, but how do you approach those patients in terms of when you think about TDXD, Peter, and what comes first, TDXD or sacituzumab?
So obviously at the moment, we can only talk about the metastatic setting. In triple-negative, HER2-low patients, I would, and I think Choi's already outlined this, I would probably choose sacituzumab first, just because we have a 500-patient randomized phase 3 trial as compared to a 60-patient subgroup out of a phase 3 trial. But actually, the data look very similar with sacituzumab and TDXD. And if you give sacituzumab as a second-line therapy, then I would give patients I heard too low TDXD as a third-line therapy in the metastatic setting. I don't think it's wrong to do it the other way around. I don't think we have clear data, but I would lean more towards where we have more data, and that's for sacituzumab at the moment.
Another chat room question, Joyce. They're the patient presenting with triple-negative disease who doesn't get neoadjuvant therapy for whatever reason, maybe it's thought to be a low-risk tumor, and is found at surgery to have, you know, a positive node. What about the use of adjuvant IO? Obviously, at indication, we don't have data, but what do you do, Joyce?
Well, fortunately, it's a very rare event, and we don't have data, but I would give the patient the benefit of the doubt. I'd still give them the KEYNOTE-522 regimen. They have node-positive disease. The idea being, you know, we like to use the intact breast cancer as kind of a vaccine to get the, you know, antigenicity going and get the immune system going, but if they have microscopic residual disease, you know, in their, you know, metastatic disease, maybe the same biology can occur. So provided I could get insurance coverage in the adjuvant setting, I would go ahead with the KEYNOTE-522 regimen.
So, Peter, you reviewed the update from AFFINITY. It's still positive, but the numbers are, you know, pretty modest looking, particularly with the node negative. Any thoughts about these data, Peter, and the role of pertuzumab right now in the adjuvant setting, how you approach it?
It feels like data from a different era, these are nearly 10-year data. But obviously, we are much more excited about new ADCs in this setting. Clearly, pertuzumab is an important drug. We use it in the neoadjuvant setting, and then we continue and have been in node-positive patients if they have a complete response. We have already switched to T-DM1 in the past in patients who have residual disease after neoadjuvant dual HER2 blockade. So I think the indication for this will be what was studied in the AFFINITY trial is getting smaller and smaller. TDXD will move into that setting, either in the neoadjuvant setting or equally, I would put personally money on the fact that it's going to be more effective than T-DM1 in the post-neoadjuvant setting. So it's interesting to see that long-term follow-up from AFFINITY, but the world is moving on very quickly in HER2-positive disease.
That's for sure. And it seems like it's moving pretty quickly as well. Joyce, again, Peter went through, we've already mentioned this, that was just presented at San Antonio, neoadjuvant TDXD with or without, this is a different one, with or without anastrozole. Looks like they benefit, but on the other hand, you don't see much in the way of path CR in this situation. Any thoughts about these data, Joyce?
So HR positive, HER2 negative, HER2 low, patients, small numbers. You can see on the right, the addition of the anastrozole did not make a difference in terms of response rates. 68% in arm A responded. They got 6 to 8 cycles of preoperative TDXD. The PATH CR rate was only 5%. 15% of patients had RCB 0 or 1, but very small numbers, like 20-something patients, and many had not gone to surgery yet. However, as I look at this curve here, the response rate 68%, and the waterfall plot, to me, if I had to guess that this is as good as preoperative AC, it may be even as good as preoperative ACT in these, but this is an unselected population. They weren't like all high 21 gene recurrence score or 70 gene signature. Okay. This was all comers, HER2 low. So again, we're only going to give cytotoxic therapy to patients we think can benefit from cytotoxic therapy. So that's important. But I'm optimistic that TDXD and HER2 low patients will eventually supplant AC, maybe not ACT, but I think this kind of is with a little bit more follow-up, more numbers, I think we'll be ready for a preoperative head-to-head with TDXD with or without taxane versus ACT.
So this has just been a little tasting menu of what's going on in breast cancer this past year. So many things we didn't talk about today, a lot of them are in the talks. We really recommend you check those out. And coming back, that's tomorrow, actually. We're going to be talking with Drs. Brown and Stevens about CLL. Is zanubrutinib better than other BTK inhibitors? We'll be asking that question a lot more tomorrow night. Joyce and Peter, thank you so much. Audience, thank you for attending. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Joyce.
Bye. Thanks, thank Peter. You. Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye, everybody.